This is fun to focus on here. We talk about the Arctic grayling in Montana. A very unique fish. They've got that huge sail on the back. They kind of look like a trout, but they're very specialized. Really need cold water. They were in Montana, the upper Missouri River Basin above Great Falls, quite a wider range. But now the only range that they have is in the upper Big Hole River in Montana, in the entire lower 48 states. And they were threatened years and years ago, and they're still threatened, right? Got a lot of work to do with it, too. But one of the things we're talking about today is the collaboration of landowners, conservation groups, and even the government about recovering this species, and it's on its way. We got that today here on Voices of Montana. I've been excited about lining this up for a while. I want to appreciate David Brooks, who's with the Montana Trout Unlimited in Montana there, executive director, who reached out and got a bunch of landowners lined up. Caitlin Colloy probably did a lot of that, too. She's with the FWP. Matt Yeager. So a bit later on, Blake Huntley will join us, fifth generation rancher in the upper Big Hole Valley near Wisdom. The sixth generation, as Jake and Guy would say, pretty young right now, but they're there on the ranch. Jake and Guy Peterson, who've also been a part of this. And I mean, to lay some of the groundwork here too, there are like 30 landowners representing about 150,000 acres, as I understand it, to help recover this species. And this goes back a few ways. The Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances, the CCAA. Let's welcome a couple of guests here first. And we got a lot of people to talk with a bit later on. Blake and Jake and Guy will join us, David Brooks as well. But Caitlin Colloy is with us with the Montana Fish and Wildlife Parks Department, riparian ecologist, and then Native Fish Program Manager for Region 3 there in the Big Hole is Matt Yeager. Caitlin, good morning, ma'am. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Hanging in there. Matt Yeager, what's going on?
Not much. Excited to talk about grayling.
Yeah, me too. Where do you guys want to start? Do we start with the program? Do we start with where the graylings were? Lay down some foundation for us.
Yeah, for sure. And so going back to your lead in, grayling were historically distributed throughout the upper Missouri Basin. The Big Hole isn't the only place they are, though. There's 19 populations left. A lot of those are up in mountain lakes. Some of them are still in stream systems. But there's probably nowhere that's more iconic than the Big Hole for grayling. A lot of people, you know, when they think of the Big Hole, think of Arctic grayling. And one of the things that's really unique about grayling in the Big Hole is that there's a couple lakes where there are grayling, but these are mostly stream-dwelling grayling.
Yeah.
And that's what grayling were historically. But now the Big Hole is one of the few places where we still do have stream-dwelling grayling.
Caitlin, go ahead and pick up from there. The fact that, you know, why did we lose historical ranges for the grayling?
Yeah, so there was a few different pressures on grayling that reduced the population. You know, a lot of these valleys that grayling was in were flood irrigated, and there was heavy use. So there was irrigation pressures, grazing pressure on the stream banks causing erosion, and I'll let you pick up.
Yeah, so I mean, some of the other things that were going on were, you know, not necessarily in the Big Hole, but other places. We saw a lot of entrainment and irrigation ditches, and also just fragmentation of habitat. It's really important for grayling to move throughout a drainage. They're not a fish that just sits in one spot. And so if they can't get to where they need to over the course of a year, that can be problematic.
The things that we can control, what are those things that we can control?
Yeah, so a lot of it are some of the things that, you know, Caitlin and I just touched on. And, you know, it's not a grayling-centric world, but to some degree we can control how much water is in a stream when, you know, given the amount that came out of the sky and got stored up as snowpack. We can make infrastructural changes. If we're seeing a lot of grayling in ditches, you know, there's screens, other ways we can mitigate for that. And then where, you know, passage is blocked, regardless of the reason, whether it's because of natural things like beaver dams or irrigation diversions, we can do things to help passage and make sure the grayling can get to the places they want to and need to.
Competition from non-native fish, how big a problem is that?
Yeah, it can be a problem in certain areas, and I think has been in certain areas. So to your point, in places where we're managing for grayling, we can have liberalized regulations on non-native fish. But if what we've seen in a lot of places, if you fix the habitat and it's in good shape, high tide raises all ships. We'll often see increases in abundance of non-native and native fish. So that definitely plays a role. But if we have intact habitat, oftentimes those can coexist.
Well, that hits the gist of the show here as well. Impacting habitat, it takes cooperation for that, collaboration too. Jake and Guy Peterson, Blake Huntley will join us a bit later on. Caton Colloy, that was Matt Yeager, by the way, Native Fish Program Manager for Region 3 there. Caton Colloy, riparian ecologist. Caton, let's talk about the candidate conservation agreement with assurances. That's sort of a strange name for a program, but you know, this is now being looked at across the country as an example of success for something like this.
Yeah, so Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances, for short, CCAA. This is a voluntary program on non-federal land, so meaning private landowners can choose to enroll in the program. And how it works is a landowner can choose to enroll. The CCAA team would go onto the property, assess the threats for grayling, and create a site-specific plan. And once that landowner signs their site-specific plan, they are assured that if Arctic grayling are ever ESA listed, they don't have to do anything beyond what was agreed upon in the site plan. So they have assurances there. And again, this is fully voluntary, so they can leave at any point.
What was the
plan? And this program focuses on four conservation measures. So kind of relating back to the threats we were just talking about, we focus on in-stream flows, riparian and in-stream habitat, fish passage, and entrainment.
How hard was it to get buy-in?
Well, so I think that kind of happens at a couple different levels. What led up to this program was us having tougher and tougher drought, right? And in 88, and Blake and Jake and Guy can speak to this, the Big Hole River went dry. Folks remember that was a horrible drought period. Yeah. But we started to get into more cycles of drought in the early 2000s. And that was really the impetus for us kind of coming together. So we talked a little bit about how grayling move in the watershed. 90% of the time, they're on private land. And so, for this to work, there had to be buy-in from the folks that were managing the resources, and that's the ranchers. From an agency perspective, I think folks were looking for a different narrative. You know, there's been a lot of sort of top-down conservation programs, some successful, some not. But, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, NRCS, Fish and Wildlife Service, DNRC, all of those agencies wanted to pull together and make sure we could find something that people would buy into and would work for them in addition to working for grayling. And we kind of have this saying, if it doesn't work for the ranchers or agriculture, it's not going to ultimately work for grayling. So the focus of this agreement and this program right from the beginning was doing more listening than telling to make sure we understood what it would take to get buy-in and build trust.
Where are we at now? Caitlin, you can, or whoever, Caitlin, Matt, where are we at now?
In the Upper Big Hole, that in the CCAA program, like you said, there's 31 landowners, about 160,000 acres, and this is covering majority of our important grayling habitat. And this program is coming up on our 20th anniversary, and all the landowners that have chosen to enroll have chosen to re-enroll, so site plans get renewed every 10 years. And so far, every single one has chosen to continue in the program. And when a property's been sold and rebought, that landowner has also chosen to keep their property enrolled. So we've kept consistent enrollment over time. And we're still full steam ahead. Every year, we're identifying projects to keep improving grayling habitat, raising funding, and working with the ranchers to get those projects done.
How much of the species is recovered? Or, you know, give us a sense of, I mean, that's a lot of landowners, as I understand, 30 plus and then 150,000 acres too. And the grayling, they move quite a bit. And then, as I understand, learning through some of this too, they don't live long. You know, they mature early and they don't have a real long life too. So I'm sure that complicates things too. Where are we at right now with the grayling? What's the encouraging news there?
Yeah, so the good news is the program's working. We've alleviated almost all of the barriers to passage. Landowners are making, on average, contributions of between 130 and 150 CFS. We're hitting the flows we need to keep grayling moving between habitats and in the habitats they need to be. And there's been a steady improvement in riparian health that's, you know, all of these things have helped buffer the effects of increasing air temperatures. So since the program began, the genetic metrics that we use to track the population, it's called effective population size, has doubled over the course of the program since the early 2000s. So folks tend to, you know, there's a lot of bad news out there. This is one of the best examples of a conservation success story happening at a time when drought hasn't gone away. If anything, it's getting worse.
That is Matt Yeager again with the FWP, Native Fish Program Manager, Region 3, riparian ecologist for the Arctic Grayling, and of course, handling that CCAA program, Caitlin Colloy. Yeah, I got to get that right. It's the lower 48 river systems, but the grayling are in some of these mountain lakes and other areas as well. And right now, the species being threatened with a lot of different reasons, so, you know, back in the late 80s and 90s, have been part of a recognizable, and folks would say it's remarkable, because, you know, their population range was much broader, and there are a lot of things that they're dealing with nowadays. Welcome back here to Voices of Montana. Tom Schultz alongside. That's our topic today, is the Arctic Grayling. Caitlin Colloy with us, Matt Yeager, they're with the FWP. A bit later on, David Brooks will join us from Trout Unlimited Montana, Montana Trout Unlimited. And actually, I'll get to that here in a moment. Welcoming Blake Huntley now, who's a fifth generation Wisdom family operations there, and has been a part of this program for how long, Blake? Good morning, sir. How are you?
Well, from the beginning, you know, I mean, it all started in 88, and you had the Big Hole Watershed Committee and other agencies get involved in trying to manage the Big Hole Watershed, you know, and with all due respect, they started with the generation above us, and I think that was, you know, really valuable because, you know, you had like my father and Harold Peterson and Ray Peterson and Ray Weaver and just many of the folks that have since passed, you know, who might think these agency folks, you know, benefited a lot in terms of listening, as Matt said, you know. So they went out and started gathering information and whatnot. And I think the key words that I've heard that, you know, really are meaningful is buy-in and voluntary and whatnot. So the original ESA was a bit of a problem in so much that I thought it was a bit condemning, you know, having a species out there and then whoever the landowner was, whether it be state, federal, or private, you know, lots of times we're condemned in a sense. And so I think this CCAA program, it's a branch of the endangered species, is a great avenue, and it's worked. And it's worked because, as Matt and Caitlin said, the agency people went out and said, listen, how do we get this to work? And you know, the truth of the matter is without the rancher or the landowner's buy-in, it isn't going to work. I mean, I had a situation when I was down in the Centennial Valley Price Creek that, you know, I could talk about, and they've heard the story and everything. I won't get into that because we'll stay focused on the CCAA program.
We love stories. We love stories.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, Tom, the thing that's important is it's voluntary. And you've got ranchers buy-in because they've got a say. They're heard at the table. They've, you know, spoke of their needs. And, you know, the truth of the matter is what really makes this program successful is it in my mind, is more of a watershed approach, and that and that's fantastic, because as they've voiced, there's 31 ranchers involved and quite a landscape, 160,000 acres, and what makes it successful is you don't lean too heavily on any one rancher in times of drought. And so at the end of the day, you know, to try and meet the needs of the fish, every rancher can give up a little bit, and every little bit amounts to quite a little bit when it comes to trying to maintain stream flows and things of this nature. And so the fact that you've got, you know, a watershed and 31 ranchers involved is a real positive, you know, in making this project successful, you know, and that. So those, you know, going back and having them just, you know, really spend the time figuring out how the agency folks I'm talking about to make this successful, they did it. And I'll just add to it, and I've said it, that really what makes it work are the people that are on the ground. You know, the fact that they get out here and visit with us, come to the ground. You know, nothing's ever solved within office doors and that. You've got to get out on the land. You've got to talk. You've got to collaborate and work with one another. And you know, we've done a great job, the ranchers, the agency folks, the state folks, Big Hole Watershed, you know, in doing this. You know, you take this year, it's going to be a challenge. You know, we've been, you know, the hit with drought a couple of years in a row and things like that. But you know what? They've proven that by just calling on ranchers and asking everybody to give up a little bit, that we can keep the river flowing in that. And I'll kind of end by saying most of us ranchers know a little bit about cattle, but these agency folks can definitely educate us because they know a lot about the fish and the needs of the fish. And that's where, you know, it's real important, because, you know, we need to know when it's important to leave water in the river, you know, and then when it can be time to go ahead and use it for irrigation, you know, and that. And so, you know, to try and not dewater the stream entirely, it's like use it when you can, release it when the fish needs it, and just work together. And it's been a success because everybody's been working real hard together.
A lot of great things articulated there, Blake. I appreciate that, Blake Huntley. And then we'll, let's talk with Guy Peterson and his son Jake Peterson, and a multi-generational family between Jackson and Wisdom, again in the Big Hole. You know, Blake, as you said, and Guy and Jake, this is for you guys. Were you concerned about the Endangered Species Act coming in, mandating? I think we've seen that being weaponized against landowners at times. Maybe that's how some people would view it, where they keep moving the goalposts. We see that with grizzly bears. We saw that with wolves. We continue to see that with wolves. And so, Guy, were you concerned, or what answers your concerns as you got into this program about being able to cooperate with the government without the government coming in and telling you exactly what they wanted you to do?
Well, Tom, I'm a bit more blunt. I'm probably less diplomatic than Matt and Caitlin. So let me just kind of summarize the whole story for you, and then there's a bunch more that follows up on that. But first, the major issues we have is Mother Nature. So it is what it is, and we deal with that how we can and whatever. Another big issue we have is predators, and it's not only invasive fish. It's other things, too, predators. And then we get to water management and habitat control. And that's where we come in. That's where the ranchers come in. So, and you ask, well, why would we? And yeah, I suppose we were kind of pressured into it. But once we were, I guess, there was pressure to do so.
Right. Yeah.
But to see the benefits. Why are we still in it? I mean, this program's been going on for a while. I mean, why are we still in it? Well, it's a little bit old school, like Blake touched on a little bit, the old timers around here. It's kind of hard to break that old school mentality. But, you know, once the newer generation seen the benefits of water management and habitat management, there's definitely some real benefits that come right down to the bottom line to ranchers. And, I'll just take, for example, right now, we're in a little bit of a kind of peculiar year here. The temperature's been up, and it's been early and so forth and so on. We're getting to a time right now. These grayling are going to be spawned here in a week. So what have we done already? A lot of us ranchers had our water on for a month. We have things wet. We have things soaked up. We're going to let some water go to maintain that stream flow. That's just one example of the things we've done. And then when we get into habitat and so forth, the timing, fencing, so forth, on our grass, on the control of our grasslands, we're really seeing the benefits of it. It just doesn't benefit the fish. It benefits the ranchers. That's why you can say, with all the cooperation. And then when we get into cooperation, government agencies, oh my goodness, what a partnership there. It's nobody's, especially the government agency. There's no hard line answers or whatever. We all get to talk about it and come up with solutions. It's really been a great partnership. That just kind of sums it up for me in a nutshell. Of course, there's all kinds of other things attached to it, but
yeah,
that's kind of my spiel.
I appreciate that, and Blake hit that as well about you know, it's the people behind the agencies here as well. I got like a minute and a half here, Jake. You're representing the next generation, and you've got family youngsters that will represent the next generation. How important is this to you?
Well, I would say, you know, probably one of my biggest goals in life is to make it possible for my kids to make the choice to keep going. And I think if we can manage this fish so we don't lose control of our water completely and stuff, so we can keep, you know, keep growing the grass we need so it's not so terribly regulated, because we have an endangered species on the list. Mm-hmm. You know, that yeah. is good. The projects we've done with the CCAA has made it possible for us to run at absolute max capacity, I would say. Good. With the water tanks and the fencing, we run, you know, just as many as we can. And without those projects, we probably wouldn't be able to keep those numbers where we want them. Well, so go ahead.
Tom,
no,
can I add a little before we lose the clock?
Nope. We have already lost the clock, but we'll come on back. We got time on the other side. And I want to understand what your needs were in this and how you guys collaborated to meet your needs as well as the needs of the Arctic grayling. So a couple of keywords mentioned, it's buy-in as well as voluntary. Ranchers, biologists working together, and how that conservation led to a recovery. Now, I don't know that we're done, right? There's always work, but this is the Arctic grayling, and it is rare in the lower 48. I think the only river system that does contain Arctic grayling is the Big Hole out of Southwest Montana. Big hello to you. Thank you guys for coming back here from Montana for Montana. Say hello to our friends in Dillon as well. KDBM, love having you guys on 1490 AM, and always appreciate being able to talk about the great things going on there. Lee, Wendy, Joanne, hope things are well for you guys. Again, a large list of folks. It's Caitlin Kaloy and Matt Yeager with the Montana Fish Wildlife Department. And then we're hearing from Blake Huntley, fifth generation rancher. And then the Petersons, Guy and Jake, are on board here too. Now into their sixth generation, but that's the, you know, will the youngsters at 4 year old right now take a liking to the farm? We sure hope so. David Brooks will join us a bit later on. I want to go back to Blake and then Pearson's as well. When I look at this I know it's a tough call to get on board for something like this, because your operations, I mean, this is your livelihood, and you make a mistake here or a mistake there, and there might not be a sixth generation. So there's, you know, you face a lot of pressure, Blake. And then as Guy had noted, some of these site specific, these projects do help the operations. Give us more from your perspective here about some of the things maybe that you had to do on the ground. How did this project attend to your needs as a business owner?
Well, that's what I wanted to touch on. Guy brought up a good point, you know, and Caitlin mentioned it, you know, that they go out and do assessments and they try and, you know, figure out what are, I guess, the prioritized largest, biggest threats that exist, you know, to the species, and let's take care of them. It's through projects. And the thing I wanted to point out is the recognition that a lot of these projects that go in, you know, it's a question of how are they financed, how are they paid. And, you know, one thing that Guy would, you know, say has been wonderful, and myself, is the rancher has not had to burden the whole cost of this project. And I would be remiss to try and mention all the names, you know, of people that have gone out, you know, to different groups to source money to fund these projects. You know, I know Jim McGee was real instrumental in that, Future Fisheries and that. And so when you start talking about putting in head gates, you start talking about putting in water tanks or riparian fencing or fish ladders, you know, there's quite a cost that's attributed to that. And, you know, we are so thankful to the agencies because they go out and gather money and source money to help pay a huge chunk of each one of these projects. And it's these projects that really aid in, you know, basically some of them are connectivity projects and that, but, you know, for riparian enhancements, you know, whether you're putting in a riparian fence or you're doing an off-water water tank or something like that. And so our hats have to be off to the agency people and just the public at large for recognizing that, you know, a lot of this is a public good and it benefits, you know, not only the grayling but a lot of other species that dwell in the riparian area. And, of course, it definitely, as Guy has said, benefits the ranchers.
Guy, what was a tough call for you as a rancher, as a business owner, as a family man, you know, through this process? Maybe talk about some of those challenges and how you address them.
Well, mindset might be first and foremost.
Oh, yeah.
But I'll tell you what, as things progress around here, and I'm sure a lot of people are thinking this right now, what's the bottom line? The bottom line, grass is our product. We market our grass to these cattle. The grass is our product. We go grass with water. Okay. Well, what is the bottom line? The bottom line is this fencing, water tanks, grass management is beneficial to us because it comes down to utilization. And if we can grow quality, quantity, more grass and manage it more effectively, it's money in our pocket. Oh, then we got, now we've approved habitat for the grayling. Oh, and then it expands further than that. Wildlife. Our wildlife enhancement here, it's definitely improved. Everybody likes to see that, including the ranchers, first and foremost. Ranchers, the, you know, John Q. Public, yeah, we enhance the wildlife also. So, yeah, it's kind of about the bottom line. When we got into it, I don't think there are that many tough choices. It's a cost-effective thing that I think it's win-win.
Yeah.
Win-win.
Yeah.
For everybody. Win-win.
Yeah, and we throw that term around kind of, you know, loosely sometimes, but this seems to be the case. Let's go back to our FWP experts here, Matt Yeager, Native Fish Program Manager, Region 3, Riparian Ecologist for the Arctic Grayling and managing the CC, that's the Candidate Conservation Agreement Assurances, CCAA program. Matt, your comments on what we're hearing from these ranchers who have volunteered and bought in for this success?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the themes has been it's a partnership, and, you know, these guys are pretty humble about it, where they say, oh, yeah, we know a little bit about cows, and, you know, they're relying on us for fish knowledge. Well, yeah, we know a little bit about fish, but so do those guys. And one thing we don't know about is, you know, in drought years like the one we're staring down the barrel of, or even other things that have, you know, we've come up against in the program through time, is ranching and what it takes to work for them. You know, we can come with some ideas, but, you know, we don't have the experience to back it. And so the reason that it's been ultimately effective for fish and for those guys is they've been partners in coming up with solutions. So when we say, you know, this is what we think the fish need or do need to make it work, what do we do about it? As often as not, it's them coming up with the solutions that we end up going with. So they've been tremendous partners in all parts of it.
I want to get one more shout out with that then to Jake Peterson. And Jake, again, you kind of do represent the next generation. When you look down the road 10 years and 20 years, what does today's experience with the Arctic grayling tell you about you managing your property and your business 10 to 20 years from now?
Well, I think if we can just continue with these projects, like my dad says, you know, affecting our bottom line, you know, the cattle prices are good right now, but we've had a lot of years where we have struggled, and yeah, I'm sure that's going to happen again. And like I said, if we can help our bottom line to help keep these things afloat for the next generation to take it over, it just helps all the way around. I mean, one of the hardest things in agriculture right now is getting these kids to stay around, because there's not a lot of money in it. And so if we can keep them from going broke and keep them rolling, I think that's going to give my kids a better chance to do it. I mean, if we got to take $100,000 out of our pocket to do a project a year, that's a pretty big dip in our checkbook. But if we can get some assistance with that, it helps quite a bit.
Well, I appreciate hearing that, too. And I'm sure Caitlin Colloy does as well. And Caitlin, I'm going to have you brag a little bit about Trout Unlimited as we come on back. But that's in reference to, and we'll do it now here, sorry. But David Brooks is standing by with Trout Unlimited, so that's on the other side here. But it sounds to me as, you know, 31 different ranchers all kind of giving a piece here and a piece there. And then you've got conservation, you know, agencies to work with. It sounds like managing this was probably not that easy.
Yeah, so that's the best part about this program is it has been in place for 20 years, and we built a lot of trust in that time period. But again, that trust was built on mutual respect and listening to the ranchers themselves. And, you know, when I come to them with an idea, they always have a way to improve it. And, you know, one thing I would always drive home too is, again, they work off site-specific plans, and we keep that name, that meaning. So it's evolved around each ranch. It is site-specific.
I get that. What were some of the challenges for you, though?
Yeah, some of the challenges for me is, you know, I'm a biologist. I don't have experience with ranching. And so they've walked me through a lot of things and helped explain it. And so, you know, that knowledge is super valuable. If we're thinking about a solution, they understand how it actually will work best.
So one of our other big challenges is what these guys talked about. How do you develop projects and get them funded? And that's where there has been, you know, partnership beyond, certainly across the agencies, but also with groups like the Big Hole Watershed Committee and Trout Unlimited, and their Montana chapters. When we're in a spot, come up short on funding, they've often been there to help fill that gap for us.
A lot of folks on board for this show, because there were a lot of folks on board for the Arctic grayling recovery, which has been going on here for 20 years. We're finding success. It's Caitlin Colloy and Matt Yeager from the FWP, Blake Huntley, Guy and Jake Peterson. They're ranchers and the landowners in the Big Hole, and they have been volunteering their efforts here as well. Part of this process, too, was the advocacy done by Trout Unlimited in Montana. And we welcome Executive Director David Brooks, who kind of got this rolling a month ago to say, hey, let's talk about this. And David, congratulations, you know, on this, along with everybody there for that. Thanks for also, you know, tuning us into it. What was Trout Unlimited's role in this?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I mean, our role predates back to the beginning of the CCAA, when our organization signed on as part of the Arctic Grayling Recovery Program with agencies, and just supporting as a core of that the CCAA. And
through the years, we've occasionally brought direct funding to projects when there's a need for non-governmental match money to get these projects done.
Oh.
But, you know, Montana Trout Unlimited doesn't own the land. We don't own the water. We don't have authority like a state or federal agency. So a lot of our role is just in advocacy and storytelling. And what I mean by that is going to Helena and spending more time with legislators than we do in the Big Hole and talking about the success of this program for both fish and for landowners and their operations, and doing the same in Washington, D.C. to make sure that the state and federal pots of money that make this work possible are well-funded, and that that money's spent legitimately. And then we also just evaluate the program, what science is going into these projects. And, you know, Matt mentioned earlier that this is one of the great successes when it comes to fisheries management. And I would just put an exclamation point on that by saying, you know, in the last 20 years, drought in Montana has been as deep but twice as long of a time period as it was during the Dust Bowl. And yet the Big Hole has not gone dry like it did in 88. In fact, it's been well watered even in tough years when it comes to being a grayling in the upper river. And yet the fish have doubled in their effective breeding population size and kept strong genetics. And, you know, that's, I don't know of another native fish program in the state of Montana that's been that successful. And so that's why we're involved. That's the story we want to tell to make sure these things get funded. And it really all goes back to where you started, that this is partnership with the agencies and seeing state and federal agencies do it right for wildlife here, and do it right by working on the ground, boots on the ground with landowners.
Yeah. And then that funding aspect of it is critical too, because that's what keeps the work going. And as Jake said, you know, if it comes out of their pockets every year, that's a tough call. Again, David Brooks, executive director with Montana Trout Unlimited, MontanaTU.org for more information on that. I got a minute left here, and David kind of led into that for you, Matt Yeager, about, you know, this whole process, 20 years, it's going strong. What are some of the lessons learned through all this?
Yeah, so I think the biggest one that resonates with all of us is, you know, one thing the agencies got right out of the gates, and that was to empower and trust in local staff to lead this program, and kind of feel it out as we went. And what we've learned as part of that is, you know, a rancher isn't a rancher isn't a rancher, a ranch isn't a ranch isn't a ranch. I mean, every single ranch has different business models, different operations, and different needs. And having, you know, the space to kind of learn by doing arm in arm with all these different individual ranches has allowed us to cater it to work on every place rather than just coming in with a single one size fits all approach. So I think as much as anything, you know, you alluded to it, other folks did too, there's still work to be done, and our challenges aren't decreasing. But in terms of building that trust and having a successful model, a lot of hate will be in the barn.
Great. We're out of time here. Kate and Colloy, Matt Yeager, Blake Huntley, the Petersons, David Brooks, thank you for the work.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.